Somewhere in the middle of this country, in the summer of 1922, a 12-year-old kid is standing in a cornfield, shielding his eyes from the August sun. He can hear something, a low sputtering bark, like a motor car engine with ideas above its station. Then he sees it, a biplane, not much more than sticks and fabric and a man in a leather helmet, dropping down over the tree line. It grazes the tops of the corn stalks and settles into the stubble field on the other side of the fence. That kid, whoever he was, probably never looked at the sky the same way again. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today, I want to talk about the airplane that made that scene possible 1,000 times over, in 1,000 different fields, in every corner of America, the Curtiss JN4, the Jenny, the most important airplane most people have never heard of. Before we get into it, a word from today's sponsor, AviationSoul.com, has done something I genuinely wish had existed when I was earning my ratings. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. Every coin tells a story. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, back to our Jenny. The story starts at the end of another story, November 11th, 1918. The Great War is over, and the United States Army is staring at a problem. During the war, they had built up the largest fleet of training aircraft the world had ever seen, somewhere around 6,400 Curtiss JN4s. The Jenny had been the backbone of American pilot training since 1916. Virtually every American and many Canadian military aviators had learned to fly in one. Every pilot who would later become famous had sat in that front seat and wrestled with that OX-5 engine and learned what it meant to feel air beneath their wings. And now the war was done, and the government had 6,400 of these things sitting in rows at airfields across the country. What do you do with 6,400 airplanes you do not need anymore? You sell them for whatever you can get. By 1919, returning veterans who knew how to fly and could scrape together somewhere between $200 and $300 could walk away with a brand new surplus Jenny. Some went for less. There are accounts of pilots picking them up crated, still in Cosmoline, for $50. For comparison, a new Model T Ford cost about $350 at the time. You could get into aviation for less than you could get into an automobile. Now here's where it gets interesting. What do you do with an airplane in 1919? There were no commercial airlines to speak of. The airmail service was just getting started, and they were notoriously particular about who they hired. There were no passenger terminals, no instrument approaches, no radio navades. There was just you and your airplane, and the open sky in a country that had never had a reason to look up. For a lot of these pilots, the answer was simple. You load up the Jenny, you fly to the next town over, you make enough noise on the way in that everybody in town notices you, and then you land in the nearest flat field and you charge people a dollar a head to take a ride. That is barnstorming. The term itself came from the world of theater. Traveling acting companies in the 1800s would rent out barn space for their shows, rolling into town unannounced and putting on a performance before moving on. The aviation barnstormers borrowed the model wholesale, storm into town, put on a show, take the money, and move on before the local authorities started asking about permits. The Jenny was almost perfectly suited to this kind of flying, and not just because it was cheap. The JN4 was a forgiving airplane. Its landing speed was somewhere around 45 miles per hour, which meant you could set it down in almost any reasonably flat field without destroying it. It had a service ceiling around 6,500 feet, plenty for stunt work. It was a two-seat tandem design, so you had a passenger seat right there in front of you. Everything about it said, take someone with you, show them something they will never forget, and charge them for the privilege. The aircraft itself was a thing of its time. Wood and wire and fabric, doped and painted and smelling of lacquer. You flew it open cockpit, which meant the wind was always in your face, and the temperature was always whatever the air had to say about it. The engine, the Curtiss OX-5, was a 90-horsepower water-cooled V8 that ran on castor oil for lubrication and had a habit of sharing that castor oil generously with the pilot sitting behind it. By the end of a long day's flying, you wore it. Your goggles, your scarf, the back of your neck, all of it. I want to pause on that engine for a moment, because the OX-5 had a personality, not always a friendly one. It would vapor lock in hot weather. It would seize if you forgot to check the water level. It had an oil pump you monitored through a small sight glass in the cockpit, a little window where you watched oil drip at the proper rate. If that drip stopped, you were about to have a very bad day. Pilots had a saying about the OX-5. Trust God, distrust the OX-5. The engine had a service life of maybe 300 hours if you took meticulous care of it. far less if you did not, and most barnstormers did not have the luxury of meticulous maintenance. You fixed what broke on the road with whatever you could find, fence wire, hardware store parts, optimism. Despite all of that, the Ox 5 had fans, real ones. Long after the engine was obsolete, veterans of the barnstorming era formed an organization called the Ox 5 Aviation Pioneers. They held reunions well into the middle of the century. They told stories they missed their engines the way old mechanics miss a particular carburetor that gave them nothing but trouble for 20 years and somehow became the mechanical love of their life. There is something about a difficult machine that bonds you to it by the early 1920s. Individual barnstormers were joining up into flying circuses. It made economic sense. One pilot doing passenger hops was a novelty. Four pilots, a wing walker, and a man who jumped between airplanes in mid-flight was an event. People drove from three counties away for events. The flying circuses had names: the Gates Flying Circus, the 13 Black Cats, the Flying Aces. They rolled into towns ahead of county fairs and harvest festivals and set up their shows with the confidence of people who knew exactly what they were selling. Wonder, pure, undiluted wonder. The wing walkers deserve their own segment someday, and maybe they will get one, but understand what those men and women were doing. Standing upright on the upper wing of a Jenny doing 60 miles per hour at 1,000 feet, no harness in many cases, just grip and balance and an absolute prohibition on thinking too hard about what would happen if they fell. Lillian Boyer made a name doing car-to-plane transfers, grabbing a rope ladder dropped from a low-flying Jenny from the running board of a moving automobile. Ethel Dare was billed as the Flying Witch and drew crowds in the tens of thousands. These were not sideshow acts. They were athletes performing genuine feats of skill at altitude, day after day with no safety net and no margin for error. What the barnstormers accomplished, beyond keeping themselves fed, was enormous. By some estimates, something approaching 1 million Americans took their first airplane ride during the barnstorming era, roughly 1919 through 1927. These were people who had never seen an airplane up close. Farmers, school teachers, factory workers, the kid in the cornfield for a dollar, sometimes less. You could climb into the front seat of a Jenny and look down at the world from 500 feet and understand in your bones what this flying thing was actually about. That mattered more than people realize. When the airlines started running routes in the late 1920s and early 30s, they were selling tickets to a public that had already been converted. The barnstormers created the demand. They flew into fields nobody asked permission for and stood in front of people who had never seen this thing and said, "You want to come up?" And people came, by the millions. Some notable names flew Jennies in those years. A young Charles Lindbergh bought his first Jenny in 1923 and worked the barnstorming circuit through the Midwest before moving on to the mail routes. He would later call those years formative, the time when he learned that an airplane was not just a machine but a relationship between a pilot and the air. Amelia Earhart took her first airplane ride in 1920, in a Jenny at Daugherty Field in Long Beach, California, flown by a barnstormer named Frank Hawks. She was taking lessons within 6 months. The era began to close around 1926. The Air Commerce Act, passed that year, required the certification of pilots and aircraft. That was the right call for aviation safety in the long run, but it was hard on the barnstormers, many of whom were flying airplanes that would never pass an inspection and flying them without licenses nobody had asked for when they started. The cost of compliance was more than the economics of the business could absorb. The Jennies themselves were aging. Wood and fabric do not age gracefully. The ships that had come out of the factory in 1917 and 18 were now almost a decade old, and 10 years of field landings and open-air storage had taken their toll. There was no new supply. Nobody else was building Ox 5-powered trainers. The era was running out of airplane. Then came May, 1927. Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic, and suddenly aviation was not about farmers' fields and carnival crowds. It was about airline schedules and overseas routes and the whole serious professional machinery of commercial flight. The barnstormers did not end with a crash. They ended with a kind of quiet obsolescence. The sky had gotten serious, and it could not hold them anymore. But here's what I carry with me from that story. Before Lindbergh, before the airline routes, before instrument ratings and Jet Airways and the whole enormous apparatus we move through today, there was a $200 surplus biplane and a veteran who knew how to fly it, and a country that had never been asked to look up. The barnstormers made that introduction. They flew into fields and set their ships down in the stubble and said, $1, you want to see what this is? And America said yes. My sources for today include the National Air and Space Museum's historical collections on the Curtiss Jenny and the archival records of the OX-5 Aviation Pioneers. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Safe skies.